Okay, I wanted to say a couple words about posture when we practice. You are free to sit on the floor. You're also free to sit on chairs. The important thing about posture is that it has two characteristics. The first is that your spine is lengthened. And the second is that your whole body just sort of hangs limp and loose. Any posture that allows for a straight spine and for a general relaxation of your body will be a suitable situation. So if you sit on the floor, by the way, do you know what these are called in Japanese? This kind of cushion? Zafu. And these rectangular cushions are called zabuton. In Japanese, za means to sit. So if you use a zafu, you can do this. This is sort of a half lotus. Actually, this is a proper half lotus. This is more like a quarter lotus. The quarter lotus sort of shades into, I don't know, that's a quarter lotus, but maybe this is 1/8 lotus. Now, if you want to sit like Soryu, you can do the classic full lotus. But this is, the magic is not in the fact that your legs are twisted into a pretzel. The magic is that this creates an equilateral triangle. You can then erect your spine, and then it's very easy to have the whole body just settle. So if you use the zafu, you can do full lotus, half lotus, quarter lotus. Then there's another way to use the zafu. Which is this concept. This one is called Seiza in Japanese, S-E-I-Z-A. Some people have special low benches that are called Seiza benches. Anybody have a Seiza bench here? Okay, could you hold it up so people can see? Ideally made to put your legs under. So if you have those, you can do that, or you can just use a zafu vertically as opposed to horizontally. That also gives you a good posture. Let's see, there's also this. Some people call this Burmese posture. Your sort of legs are sort of out to the side like that. If this works for you, this is allowed to. If you sit in a chair, it's recommended that you not lean back. You might support just your rump, okay, back here, the back of your tush, you might support, but try to have most of the spine freestanding. Now, I'll be honest, it takes a little while to learn how to have the spine straight but also everything relaxed. They've done research though on very experienced Zen monks, and what they found is that even after hours, many hours of upright sitting, the muscles of their spine are more relaxed than a person who's asleep. In other words, something changes in the physiology of the muscles as time goes on that allows one to maintain this upright posture completely through balance with very little muscular effort. But until your body sort of modifies to be able to do that, you'll have to over and over again lengthen the spine and then let yourself settle like that. Ordinarily in the meditation hall, we don't have people lie down. The exception is if you have a physical condition that makes it impossible to practice seated, then it's okay to lie down. Lying down has the obvious danger. What's the obvious danger? So the good news about lying down is there's a lot of relaxation. The bad news is there might not be much clarity. When you stand, which you are allowed to do anytime, you'll have more clarity. And you can learn how to relax into the standing up position also. So that's your range of options as far as postures go. And I've been noticing that people have been standing, and I like that when people stand, because people that are seated, they may or may not be conscious. But if you're standing, I know you're conscious. If you're seated, you might be sort of, you know, sort of half asleep kind of thing. Remember, Buddha means awake in Sanskrit. If you get sleepy, you can open your eyes. Meditate with your eyes open, even wide open. Just sort of defocus the outside world. You let light in, but you sort of like let go of the color and form of the outside world. If that's too agitating to you, you can close your eyes. That's okay too. Or something in between, sort of half eyes like this. Whatever aperture of the eyes helps you remain alert. But if it's a choice between this, okay, and this, force your eyes open. Because remember, Buddha means awake, alert. Let me see here. As far as breathing goes, we're not going to do any special exercises with the breath. But we would encourage you to breathe silently. Try not to make noise as you're breathing. And most people breathe through the nose, unless you have some physical condition. So the straightness of your spine causes, physiologically, your brain to wake up. There's something called, technically, the reticular activating system in the central nervous system, and it's sensitive to posture. So when your posture wilts, you know what I mean by wilt? Like a leaf wilting?
Novelle.
Yeah. When your posture wilts, that turns off the alertness of your brain. Conversely, when your posture is upright, that activates the reticular activating system. It goes all over the brain and sort of wakes up the brain. So on one hand, your posture is a biofeedback device, meaning when it wilts, that's information that you're losing clarity. Conversely, when it's upright like this, that gives you the feedback, the information that physiologically clarity is present. The relaxing of the body opens the body and broadly opens consciousness, and that gives you an equanimity quality. We're going to talk about equanimity this evening. It's a technical term and has some subtleties involved. But basically, the posture, the straightness gives you sensory clarity. The relaxation gives you equanimity. So there are some teachers that only teach posture. There's a form of Zen in Japan called just sitting. That's it, okay? The posture is the path. the spine is straight, the body is relaxed, and time does the rest. When I first started to meditate, I was in Japan, and I met an English lady who had been practicing Zen for 20 years. She's got a German name, but she was an English national, Imgard Schlögel. And she asked me how long I'd been meditating, and I said, about 6 months. And she said, well, it will take you 8 years to learn about posture. And I thought, oh, this is one of those things that the Zen people say to sort of like blow your mind. You understand what I mean? What's the idiom? Like shock you, right? Shock you. It's like, oh, you know, it's going to take you 8 years just to understand the posture, you know, what to say of enlightenment. So that was about 40 years ago. And I will tell you, I'm still learning from the posture. It was an understatement. So, any questions about the posture piece?
Eight years in 1 minute,
yes. Okay, good. Now, when a person has a strong emotional experience, either pleasant or unpleasant, that's a window of opportunity. Very often, unfortunately, the strong emotional experiences are unpleasant. The big three: anger, fear, and sadness. Okay? But then there's shame, impatience, disgust. Now, there are, of course, pleasant emotional experiences: interest, fascination, joy, love, gratitude, smile, laughter, and so forth. When you have a strong emotional experience, even if it's an uncomfortable one, like fear, anger, sadness, and so forth, it's a window of opportunity, because when emotion is strong, the body aspect becomes obvious. When emotions are present but not very strong, it may be difficult to notice the body changes, at least initially. But when the emotion is strong, it will be obvious what happens in the body. That means that you can make use of that, if you wish, to work with that aspect. We'll use the English word feel to mean the body sensation part of an emotion, whether the emotion is pleasant, unpleasant, or mixed, whether the emotion is strong, medium, or very small, very subtle. As I say, when the emotion is strong, it is easiest to detect the body component. So when you have an emotion that's strong enough that you can detect the feel tangibly, it's a window of opportunity. You can note it, focus on it, open up to it, make friends with it. If you do that, you will develop a kind of sensory clarity, so that when emotions happen that are less strong, you'll still be able to detect the feel component. And eventually, you'll start to notice during the day that there is very often a very subtle undercurrent of feel going on. But it takes a little while to develop enough sensitivity to have that kind of body radar that can detect subtle feel. As you You understand what I mean by subtle?
Meudan.
Yeah, it's thin, okay, not intense. And now, in English, there's an idiom that I made up, a phrase that I use. Subtle is significant, okay? Subtle body sensations influence people's behavior constantly without them knowing it. So the ability to detect them is very, very useful. Also, it is the feel that drives people's behaviors in interpersonal interactions. And if you don't detect the feel when it arises, it will hijack your consciousness. You know, hijack, okay? If the terrorists are in the cockpit, it's too late, okay? They have control of the plane. And the way that the emotions distort our behaviors, not all emotions distort us, okay? But if they do distort us, it's usually because we didn't detect the body part of it, and it took over. And then later on, we look back and we say, why did I do that? Well, something hijacked you. So the ability to, the sensory clarity, the somatic clarity, the body clarity, to detect when emotionality is present is extremely important from the viewpoint of human life, human behavior, human interactions. And of course, human interpersonal interactions are simply magnified at a large scale into what is called international interactions. So we start at the level of the person. So that's why I introduce the term feel. When you sit in meditation, because typically there is not much going on to stimulate you, typically there's actually not very much feel, okay? If I, you know, ask you to close your eyes and tell me whether you have feel, something that seems emotional in your body, probably most of you would say right now, no. There's just touch, there's hot, there's, you know, the cushion, there's my breathing. There's nothing emotional happening. Under these circumstances, typically there's not much feel. However, at some point you may find that you're angry, or you're remembering something sad, or you're worrying about something. Then look what's happening in the body. There is probably some feel, especially if the emotion is strong. On the other hand, let's say that you get really relaxed and everything gets restful and you're like happy, okay? Well, are you smiling? Is there a rosiness in your chest in reaction to the fact that you're like relaxed and so forth? You're having pleasant feel reactions to going into states of meditation. So you may find that as you become more concentrated and more settled, that there's a smile on your face or a joy in your heart. If you can detect that, that's feel. Remember, feel it can be pleasant or unpleasant or a mixture of those. So I choose my words carefully. It could happen. Not it will happen. Not it must happen. Not if you do this right, you'll finally have it happen. Okay? I'm not saying any of those. I'm saying it could happen as you're practicing at this retreat that you have emotion and the body component, the body part, is evident. If so, if you wish, you can note that as feel and focus on that for a little while. And just It might be in one part of your body, it might be over your whole body. For now, if you do that, just ignore the touches for a little while and just work with that feel. And then if it goes away, then you can go back to touch. If it sticks around and you're interested, you could continue to work with it. So I would like to ask if there are any questions just about what I just talked about.
Should we,
yes.
Focus on the physical sensation that was brought up by the emotion, or to the thought that brought up the emotion?
Okay. You'll remember my diagram. I had three balls, okay? There's image, which is visual thinking. There is talk, which is auditory thinking. And then there's feel in the body, which is the body sensation. I use the word sensation. So with this exercise, you would be focusing on the body sensation. That's what we're going to call feel. The thinking part of the emotion, I'm going to show you how to work on that in a day or so. So you'll just be focusing on the feel. We're doing Vipassana meditation or mindfulness meditation, so you don't need to figure out why you're having that feel. Okay? Neither do you need to figure out what you're going to do about that feel, other than concentrate on it with clarity and equanimity. There is a difference between mindfulness meditation and psychotherapy. Okay? In psychotherapy, you ask yourself, what does this feel mean? Why is it happening? What should I do about it? That's, of course, a legitimate investigation. But in mindfulness, usually we don't do that. We simply try to be clear about the present sensory event. Okay? Good. Yes. Oh, a little louder, please. It's a good question. I understand your question.
Can you repeat it?
Yeah, yes. The question is, and correct me if I didn't get it right, I don't understand how I can go to my body and figure out which is touch and which is feel. I got the question right. Actually, I am not asking you to do that. That is impossible to do. So what I'm asking you to do is related, but not that. If you have emotion, okay, then look to the body, has something changed? That's the feel. If you look to the body first and say, where is the emotion? You'll just drive yourself crazy. You do it the other way around. It's like, oh wait, I'm angry now. What has changed in my body? If you detect something, that's the feel. Okay? Does that help? Yes, let me, I will take your question. I just have one other comment to make. You'll remember the way I defined it. I gave, I think I gave the definition here.
Yes. The night before, last night.
Yeah. It's one English word, feel, but I gave a long, complicated sentence, okay? I said, body sensation that seems to you at a given time to be emotional in nature. So by saying body sensation means it has to be something detectable in the body. By saying to you means you get to decide. It will be different for different people. You make your best guess. Does this seem to be where the emotion is in my body? Just make a guess. And then I said, at a given time. Because at one time, you could have heat on your face that's just the heat of the sun. It doesn't seem emotional in nature. At another time, somebody embarrasses you in public and you have heat on your face. It seems emotional in nature at that time. Now you might say, gee, that's awful subtle and complicated. Why bother with that? But once we have a clearly defined term like this, we have the possibility with time, as weeks, months, years go on, you have the concept, feel. With time, your body radar will get more and more sensitive. So my goal is not, this is not my goal. My goal is not, right now, you go to your body and guess, is this sensation touch or feel? That is not what I'm asking you to do. You can't do it, and it will just drive you crazy. My goal is, you have a concept, a definition. Now, for the rest of your life, when something comes up emotional, you have a name for the body part of it. And if you're looking for that, then with time, in the long term, you're going to develop a new sensory modality. I think that's clear. Now, I'm sorry I interrupted. Please continue. If you have physical pain, we won't call that feel. We'll consider that to be touch. It's uncomfortable touch. But you noticed, if I understood correctly, and correct me if I didn't hear because it's a little far back, you had some old pain come up and then it dissipated, and then you found yourself smiling. That smile is absolutely an instance of feel. But the pain would be touch, usually. Okay. Under some circumstances, when emotion is strong, it's easy to detect the feel. When emotion is not so strong, you may or may not be able to detect it, and don't worry about it. One of the things that I'm hoping to be able to do is have you do some meditation listening to music. People typically have noticeable feel reactions to music. It's completely unpredictable, though, whether it will be pleasant, unpleasant, or both, depending on the associations you have with a certain kind of music. So when I have people work with feel, I will often play music in the meditation hall and have you work with that. If we can set it up, I'm planning on doing that. Good. Any other questions about posture or the concept of the terminology that I've given you? Yes.
Tnucha.
Tnucha?
Yes.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Yes. Asana, in the Sanskrit language, asana, tanuha. Okay, very good. Yes. A little louder, please.
Posture and pain comes like when maintaining it up straight
Okay. When you're sitting, the longer you sit, after a while, if you sit without moving, your body starts to hurt. If you continue to sit without moving, it hurts more and more and more. First just in one place, then in a lot of places, then everywhere, then everywhere really intensely. And as the pain gets more intense, more widespread, and lasts for a longer time, you not only have pain, but you start to have talk of, well, in English we'd say like, this sucks, okay? Okay, it's like, oh, I hate this, when's this gonna be over? I hate meditation, I hate Shinzen, I know it's time for the bell to ring. It doesn't hurt him, he's been meditating for 40 years, okay? So you have talk. By the way, it does hurt because I'm old. Yeah, the more you meditate, the less it bothers you, but then the older you get, right? Then it starts bothering you again, or at least hurting again. Yeah. So you get talk, you get mental picture of whatever, and you get impatient, you get angry, you get fearful, you get feel, okay? So as the pain grows, all four elements activate. So the question is, well, at what point should I move, okay, to relieve the discomfort? Well, we're here to learn. We're not here to see how tough we are or to prove how tough we are.
We're not in the military service.
We're not in the military service, correct. So, as a general principle, when you reach the point that you're not meditating, but it's just grim endurance, and you're not learning, you're just sort of like hanging on for dear life, okay? So then you move, because we're here to meditate, not to have grim endurance contest. So as a general principle, when your meditation technique breaks down and you're not really meditating anymore, then make yourself comfortable. Now remember I said I created a phrase in English, subtle is significant. Small things can be very significant. Small...
Mashmauti.
Yeah, how would you translate subtle is significant?
Me'udan ze mashmauti.
Okay. So, small movements of your body can give you a lot of relief. Just little movements, you get a lot of relief. So, you may not have to move in a big way. You start by moving in a little way. If that doesn't give you sufficient relief, then you're allowed to move. Now, be glad that we're doing Vipassana as opposed to Zen, because in Zen, every sit is what's called strong determination sit. You're not allowed to move at all. Even if it's 2 hours, you cannot move any part of your body. And if mosquitoes come, you can't move. Okay, no matter what. So, what we're not doing is that. So, you are allowed to move if you wish. So, as a general principle, when you're no longer meditating, we came here to meditate, so shift to the minimum you need in order to once again be able to meditate. I say as a general principle because every once in a while, see what it's like to not do that. See what it's like to go beyond what is reasonable. But never to the point where you would physically damage the body. But you can get to fainting levels of pain without physically damaging your body very easily. Your eyes begin to roll up into your head, okay? Your whole body shakes, okay? Every once in a while, be willing to explore that. Maybe not in your first retreat, okay? But sometime in your meditation career, be willing to see what if I really went into it and let my eyes roll in my head and my body shake and my mind become completely insane. What is on the other side of this? I will tell you a story from my own personal experience. So when I did my first 1 week retreat, it was in Japan. It was in the Zen tradition. It was very hot, actually hotter than this. It was in southern Japan. And the very first night, the Roshi, the Zen master, came out and he went around the room and he hit everyone, every single person, with a stick. Now, understand, they hit you here. This is an acupuncture point, here and here, that it wakes you up and it relaxes you. So it's not like they're hurting your body, but it's very startling when you first see that happen. And throughout that retreat, you were never allowed to move during the sits. And if you moved, they would break the stick on you. Now, they don't damage the body, okay, but it sort of damages your ego. It doesn't physically harm you. No bones are broken. No muscles are injured. They hit you right on this pad here, but they hit you that hard. So it's very scary. And there were mosquitoes, okay? And so by the end of the day, I would be like, that's called holding on for dear life, okay? My whole body shaking uncontrollably. It's like, you know, this is called a mudra, okay? Well, this was my mudra, okay, like this. So this went on for a week. And the last sit, I thought I was going to lose my mind. And I realized that I was about to start crying. We say bawling. Okay, you understand what bawling, that's like full body crying without any hesitation. I was going to start bawling like a little baby. I was completely destroyed and regressed to an infantile helplessness and terror and pain. And so, now, hey, you don't have to go through this, okay? I hope that by using my techniques and my terminology, you can get the same effect without going through this. Work smarter, okay? But Soryu and I had to do it the old-fashioned way, and he can tell you many stories along these lines, actually worse than my stories, because he was in a harder temple than I was in. But anyway, so I was gonna cry. And in my talk space, I started to scream, "You're not a baby, don't cry. You're not a baby, don't cry." That was my mantra, okay? Screaming that. Because I just hold on, okay? It's just like one more sit. And I was screaming, "You're not a baby, don't cry. You're not a baby, don't cry." And at some point, my entire body spontaneously relaxed. My internal talk and mental images vanished. The pain was still there, but it was like a river flowing. This huge smile came over my face. For the first time ever in my life, I experienced mental calm, and the pain was absolutely as intense as it had been previously. But now in my talk, I heard I could stay like this forever, and nothing needs to change. This pain could be exactly like this forever. And there was a smile on my face. And I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. What happened? I stayed with the pain long enough so that I spontaneously dropped into equanimity with it. And if I hadn't stayed with it, if I hadn't been forced to stay with it beyond the reasonable point, I would not have had that experience, not as quickly, I don't think. That happened to me in my first retreat. And that showed, that was like a brave new world. That's an idiom we have in English, okay, from Shakespeare. A brave new world. It's like, oh my God, in theory, a human can transcend even fainting levels of pain. And transcend not in the sense of endure, but in the sense of experience it as not a problem. So maybe at some point go beyond what is reasonable. Over the months and years and decades of your life, you can explore that world, that possibility. Okay, good. Any other questions just about this? Yes.
Another question about pain. I know that if I'm stay focusing on one point in my body which I have pain, at one point or another it will become to be not pain anymore.
Yes.
And sometimes it's my hidden motivation to stay there. And it's not really, you know, coming out of equanimity, it's coming out of want to get rid of the pain. And I wonder what to do about this.
Okay, very good. We would say in English you had an agenda, that the pain agenda is like a plan, right? So first of all, the fact that you know this is the case is...
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, okay. Sometimes, if I have a pain and I focus on it, I know that often what you just described will happen, okay? That the pain will be no longer suffering. But now I notice that I sometimes want to stay with it so that that will happen. And so in a sense, there's not equanimity. What should I do about that? Do I have it right? I would say that knowing that that's the case is already half of the solution. Okay, you know conceptually that you have that agenda. So then the trick is, sometimes then don't focus on it, you know, focus on something else, okay? And try letting go of that agenda intentionally so that you have flexibility. I would say that's the one solution. A little more broadly, where does the agenda come up? The agenda comes up in talk and image and feel. So you can observe that desire that it break up in terms of it, the feel, image, talk. And then you have equanimity with your judgments about what's happening. So that's sort of like a second level of equanimity. Okay, good. I think we have covered what we need to cover. So now let's practice. Thank you. your spine and let your whole body settle. Stretch up and settle in. Now, bring your attention to your body. It's possible that there's something emotional going on in your body right now. That is probably not the case, but it is possible. If so, if you wish to work with that, let your attention go to those emotional sensations and moment by moment note them as feel. You probably don't have feel. In that case, then focus on the non-emotional sensations, the different kinds of touches, the purely physical side of the body, noting touch, touch, if at some future time something happens, either spontaneously or the result of external stimulus situation, that causes emotion, you can switch, if you wish, to focusing just on the emotional sensation, noting it as feel, feel. That may or may not ever happen at this retreat, but you at least have that option. So now, either note touch or feel as you wish.
Daily stimulation.
period of stretch meditation out on the lawn.